Bucks were off last night. The Bulls beat the Heat 113-103. Tonight, the Bucks play the Cavaliers in Cleveland. Bulls meet the Hawks in Atlanta. NHL, Blackhawks off last night. They play the Nashville Predators tonight. Now, the forecast from the National Weather Service, mostly cloudy and cold. Today's high 27. Right now, 8 degrees Kenosha, 7 in Racine, wind northwest at 5, wind chill is at 0. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
For this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be taking an intriguing look at what is known as Generation Z, or the Gen Z generation. That is those folks born between 1997 and 2012. And trying to understand kind of the mindset of the typical member of Gen Z. And this is done through a very interesting book called What Would Gen Z Do? Everything You Don't Know About Gen Z, But Should. The author of the book, John Schlimm, is an educator, artist, award-winning author, and someone who has really thought a lot about Generation Z, and much through his experience as a teacher and in many of the artistic collaborations which have been a part of his life. And he has brought all of that experience and creativity into this really, really wonderful book, which we're going to be talking about, again, called What Would Gen Z Do? Everything You Don't Know About Gen Z But Should. John Schlimm, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hey, Greg, good morning. And I have to say, I love your part of the country, Milwaukee, Chicago, all of Wisconsin and Illinois. I've been there a lot of times, and I know that you have some amazing Gen Zers as well as people who live and work with them. So I'm so excited to be with you and your listeners today.
So one of the things that I appreciated is that you come at this question or this task of understanding Gen Z as someone who is an educator, and my other life apart from the radio station involves teaching at a local college. So I really resonated with many of the observations that you made. As you said about the task of kind of putting this down, did you already understand Gen Z, or to some extent did that understanding become deeply enhanced just through the act of writing this book?
Well, really, my understanding and journey with Gen Z is what led to the book. I have spent the last 5 years both in my classroom as well as when I've been traveling across the country sitting down with Gen Zers and really getting to know them. You know, I first met them in my classroom here in Pennsylvania. I instantly was just so inspired by how courageous and honest they were in sharing their stories, especially when it came to mental health. And that was the immediate connection point between me and them. And I just wanted to keep learning more. And so anytime I traveled across the country, I made sure I was also sitting down with Gen Zers wherever I went, because I really wanted to know, am I going to hear the same thing as I'm hearing in my classroom? And I did. So What Would Gen Z Do is really a collection of everything I've learned about them, as well as everything they have wanted me to tell the rest of the world about them. And I'm so humbled and honored to get to be their messenger, because they are so misunderstood by the majority of our society. And I'm hoping that this book will really help to reintroduce who they truly are.
One of the most striking observations you make, and you already touched on it a little bit, is the fact that with Gen Z, with Generation Z, we are talking about people who, at least by and large, are much more open, we might even say radically open, when it comes to matters such as their own mental health, their issues with anxiety or depression, and so on. And it's interesting because in many respects, it might seem like many of those issues are far more prevalent than they once were. And perhaps they are more prevalent, but certainly part of the equation is just that this is a generation that speaks about those matters so much more openly than, for instance, the baby boomer generation of which I am a part. I think that is a valuable thing for us to know and to consider.
I love to think of Gen Zers as being authentically imperfect. They so proudly wear their imperfections on their sleeves. They're not ashamed to talk about them. They're not embarrassed to talk about them. And really, you know, that first connector point for me is when I heard them speak aloud words like anxiety, depression, suicide, I need help, and they would tell their stories. I'd never experienced that before with another group of young people, and certainly, you know, when I was coming of age as a Gen Xer in the 80s, we certainly had those issues, but we weren't allowed to talk about them. So when I heard Gen Zers speaking these words, I instantly knew this was a starting point for what was going to set them apart. And, you know, I saw their easy nature in speaking these words as the biggest leap forward the world has ever seen in mental health advocacy. And it has really pulled me into being a champion for mental health. And I think what it does is it inspires the rest of us to be more open about our own journeys. You know, for example, I've had a, at this point, 51-year journey with anxiety. And because of Gen Z, I'm very public about that. And I talk about that. So absolutely, and I think it's so many other topics as well. The ease with which they're able to talk about them is so inspiring.
A couple of things that I think are worth our talking about is one of them is the proclivity of or tendency of Gen Zers to multitask. That's something that I happen to also like, even though I'm 62 years old and far from being part of that generation. But you help us understand how that is just a characterization, a characteristic that we should not misunderstand or maybe draw a fence from as quickly as we might otherwise. Where do you think that tendency to multitask, to be attentive within the framework of multitasking, where do you think that comes from?
I think it comes from them being raised in a moment in time when there is so much going on around them, so much noise, but also so many amazing things that I think it's been wired into their DNA from birth. You know, not only are there multiple avenues for technology, you know, think of all the television channels we have now, but also all of the gadgets, iPads, iPhones, computers, you know, virtual reality, headset, like there's so much that's going on, as well as, you know, these young people were raised not only going to school all day, but then multiple extracurricular activities, be involved in everything. You know, their schedules have been jam-packed since they left the maternity ward. So I think that it's just second nature to them to be able to juggle a lot of balls at once. And, you know, I think this is something that's vastly misunderstood about them. You know, we see them on their phones or on their iPads, and we think, oh, my gosh, that's all they do all day. They're rotting their brains. You have to sort of check yourself and maybe actually ask them, because my number one suggestion when it comes to Gen Z is if you want to know something, ask them. Ask them what they're doing on their phones. Ask them what they're doing on their iPads. And you might be really surprised. You know, when I see my students in class, maybe on their iPhones or iPads. You know, for all I know, they could be running a small country somewhere, and it would not surprise me one bit. But I know every time I've called on them, they've had the answer. So that taught me early on that they can focus on a lot of things at once. And I think especially as they're now moving into the workforce, that's an important thing for employers to understand about them, because that's going to be a great asset to any job they're going to take on.
You explore all kinds of different matters, including a tendency to procrastinate, the way in which spirituality might play a part in their lives, maybe not in the ways that would be particularly obvious. You talk about the innovative spirit of so many, and on and on. One that really leapt out at me is when you say, the 20th century is ancient history to the typical Gen Zer. And of course, for those of us born in the middle of the 20th century, that takes a little getting used to, doesn't it?
It does, but you know, it also becomes a really great conversation starter. And one of the points of this book is really promoting that intergenerational connection and communication. And that's why I really wanted this book to be interactive. At the end of every chapter, there's a reflection question for you, the reader, to ask yourself, but also a question for you to ask a Gen Zer. There are projects at the end, really fun projects, because at the end of the day, I want you to have fun with the Gen Zers in your life. They're a really fun bunch, which is not an adjective you hear associated with them that much, but they're really fun. And so these are activities that you can do in the classroom, but you could also do at home within the family or a community center. So I really do want that connection to happen, and I want older people to get to know who these people are, and I hope that this book can be that starting point.
The book, again, is What Would Gen Z Do? Everything You Don't Know About Gen Z But Should. It's a Familius publication, and the author, John Schlimm. John Schlimm, congratulations on a terrific book. I enjoyed it start to finish, and it was fun to speak with you about it. Thank you so much, and best wishes.
Well, Greg, and thank you for being a journalist who is turning the tide and helping the world to better understand who Gen Z is. So I appreciate your efforts as well.
You're welcome. Listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And part two of today's program is from the Morning Show archives. I suspect that some of you may remember a very interesting interview, which I conducted probably now a couple of years ago, with author Deborah Tannen about a fascinating book which she wrote called You're Wearing That, a book which explored the interaction between mothers and daughters. And Deborah Tannen is someone who has really studied for a long time the way in which we interact. She is a professor of linguistics at Georgetown University, and her experience and expertise has led her to write not only You're Wearing That, but also You Just Don't Understand. Her latest book is called You Are Always Mom's Favorite, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives. And Deborah Tannen, in this book published by Random House, is doing very much what she did in the book we talked about before, exploring the way in which sisters interact. And some of the issues are the same as mothers and daughters speaking. Some are quite different. And as we read, we get to thinking about the way we choose words, the way in which the words we speak can sometimes be conveying hidden layers of additional meaning, sometimes very much inadvertently. And the way in which we use language in ways to sustain one another, sometimes to hurt one another, both knowingly and unknowingly. What a complicated and fascinating story this is. And Deborah Tannen writes about this with such discernment. And she joins us for the next few minutes to talk about her book, which is again called You Are Always Mom's Favorite, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives. Deborah Tannen, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you. So nice to talk to you.
Looking forward to, again, talking. especially for the sake of our listeners who might not remember our previous conversation or maybe didn't have the pleasure of hearing it, I think it would be good for you to remind them how that previous book and this book also took shape in terms of the way in which you went about studying this matter of, in this case, how sisters converse, or previously how mothers and daughters converse. How did you go about studying that?
For the book, You Were Always Mom's Favorite, I talked to over 100 women about their sisters, and I got a range of ethnic, regional, class, age, from college age to their 90s, not to compare one group to another, but just to get a spread of representative examples. For the mother-daughter book, I also interviewed people, but not quite as many, I think something like 30. But my method, I'm a professor of linguistics, not psychology, and my basic method in my academic research is to record conversations, transcribe them, and study the transcript. So in both books, I do have some examples of actual transcribed conversations. I also take examples from literature, from film, from people that I didn't interview at length, but simply ran into. And you know, it's when you're doing a topic like this, I tend to have conversations like the following: "Hi, what are you working on now? Sisters, do you have any?" And then immediately I hear all the examples and anecdotes from the person I'm speaking to.
So you have not had to scratch very deeply to get people to talk about this, to share their thoughts. And I suppose the biggest trick was you really wanted a wide swath of examples to really enhance the value.
Yes. And what I tried to do is perceive patterns in the many anecdotes that I hear. And I'll tell you one that, since I outlined that kind of conversation that I have, a remark that really captured a lot of what I heard in the many interviews. A woman said, "What are you working on?" I said, "Sisters, do you have any?" And she said, "Yes." And then she said, "We were never close. We're very different," about her sister. And I almost laughed, because just about everybody I talked to told me almost immediately whether or not they're close and that they're different. And this contrasted with the mother-daughter book in the sense that I heard from mothers about daughters and adult daughters about mothers. Sometimes I heard we're different, but sometimes I heard we're the same. And it might be we get along because we're different, or it might be we get along because we're the same. It might be we conflict because we're different or because we're the same. But with sisters, I almost invariably heard how they are different, which really made me see how understanding who you are often is a matter of understanding who you are in relation to your sister.
Right. It is in contradistinction that we sometimes get the clearest sense of ourselves. I mean, not just I am like this, but also I am not like this.
Exactly. And families often characterize siblings, this would be true for brothers as well, as in contrast to each other, the outgoing one and the shy one, the athlete and the bookworm. And for sisters, often I think really common and regrettable, I would say, the pretty one and the smart one. And that seems to be more for sisters than for brothers, that you run into that.
Right.
What's so destructive about it is that they end up thinking you can't be both. So a compliment to one can be heard as an insult to the other. She tells my sister she's pretty, she must be implying that I'm ugly. She tells my sister she's smart, she must be implying that I'm dumb.
Or if she says I'm smart, she thinks I'm not pretty or whatever.
Exactly. You know, absolutely. Yes, and, absolutely. And in two cases that I encountered, the smart one and the pretty one were identical twins, which really shows that often it's our impulse to compare more than reality.
In the chapter called Compare and Contrast, you write this: "We tend to see patterns in the people and things around us, so the world seems less chaotic and more manageable. Families, too, perceive patterns to make sense of behavior and find order in the family world. Sometimes this means pigeonholing each other, settling upon labels that define who each person is, and fixing them there like bugs in amber. The thing that I find interesting about this is that when you described what you do as a linguist and what you went about doing in terms of writing this book, in a sense, I mean, and I'm practically quoting you, you did the same thing. I mean, you said you said something about looking for patterns. And in a sense, for anybody who studies anything, that's sort of part of the process. And I guess the key is to do that carefully and sensitively.
Yes, that's such a good point. And when you're doing qualitative research, as this is, there's always the risk that you're going to interpret something in a way that others would not. It's not like statistical research where you have statistical reliability, although there, too, researchers then interpret their findings, and that is just as interpretive as qualitative research is. Yeah, so the examples that I present are illustration. They're not proof of anything. I think the proof is in the reaction of those people who read it and say, it rang true. I saw myself on every page. It's such a relief to know I'm not the only one.
And what intrigues me, too, is that you acknowledge in the preface that not everything you say here is exclusively true of sisters, that there are shades of some of this between brothers and sisters and between brothers, just as in your previous book, some of what you saw between mothers and daughters is also, it can exist in other sorts of parental relationships. So you know, when you're talking about conversation between sisters, it isn't that these things exclusively occur between sisters, but you write this at one point. There is a particular texture and special complexity of conversations among sisters because they are women. Talk a little further about this particular texture and special complexity. What is at the heart of it?
Yes. Two aspects that seem to distinguish sisters from brothers, although anything I say, there's always going to be exceptions, but the tendency is for sisters to talk more and for the closeness to be judged in a way on the basis of that talk. So many women feel that being close, and a way I put it is close, is the holy grail of many women's relationships. They want to be close. And I frequently heard, I wish we were closer. I never heard, I wish we weren't so close. For many women, the gauge of being close is whether you tell each other confidences, what's going on in your life, what you're worried about, problems. There's a word, troubles talk, that is often used to describe the kind of talk that many women assume is a sign of a close relationship. So that seems to be generally true of sisters more than brothers, so that a sister might be really hurt to find out that her sister had something problematic going on in her life that she didn't talk about, where a brother might say, well, she told me when she was ready, and I want to be here for her when she wants to tell me, but if she doesn't, I respect that. So that's one thing that seems to be different. Another seems to be a tremendous sensitivity to being left out. And this goes back to the way boys and girls socialize with their friends as children. Research by anthropologists, psychologists who have studied children at play, they found that girls will punish a girl they don't like by locking her out. And that seems not to be the case among boys. There certainly are boys they don't like, but they tend not to. One day you're allowed to play, and the next day shut the door, you can't even play, we won't talk to you. That's much more the way the girls' social groups work. And I think partly because of that, girls develop a great sensitivity to being left out. And I frequently hear from sisters of how they were hurt because they weren't invited to something or they weren't included in something. So that's another thing that seems particular to girls. And when you have more than two sisters, there's always that risk that one or more will feel left out. And it could be because you told some piece of information to one and not the other. This is something kind of interesting. the TV show 2020 did a segment on this book, and the correspondent was Juju Chang, who herself is one of four sisters. So they had segments of her talking to her sisters. And they commented that when one has some important piece of personal information to impart, pregnancy, marriage, getting, you know, and anything significant in terms of their personal lives, they have concluded that they have to have a conference call because all the sisters have to be told at the same time. If you make a single call, you're going to call one before the other, and whoever was not called first is going to be hurt.
Wow.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of guys would find that a little hard to understand. I think a lot of women would say, yeah, of course.
We're speaking with Deborah Tannen. We're talking about her most recent book, which is called You Were Always Mom's Favorite, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives. It's probably important for us to not neglect the subtitle, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives. In fact, chapter one of your book is titled Sisters in Lifelong Conversation. You say everything said between sisters carries meaning not only from what was just said, but from all the conversations that came before, and before can span a lifetime. I think this is so fascinating because it points to something which in the moment can be both a wonderful, beautiful, rich thing, and yet something that can be so problematic and so, in a sense, kind of limiting and ultimately so terribly frustrating. Talk about that matter of the lifelong conversation between sisters.
Yes. So I heard from women, my sister just has to say one word and we crack up laughing because it's referring to a past, stories that they shared, references that they share. But then I also heard, my sister can say one word and throw me into a tailspin. She's the one who knows all the buttons, and she pushes them. So that, too, is a reference to past conversations, so they know what the other is sensitive about. And sometimes the sister who is thrown into the tailspin thinks it's a reference when it really isn't, because a lot of these things are just implications. So much of what we react to, I often, in many of my books, make the distinction between message and meta-message. So that's M-E-T-A, meta-message, where the message is the meaning of the word, so we all agree on that. But the meta-message is what does it imply that we say something like that? And there can be a lot of difference in terms of what you intend and what the person hears, or maybe what you want to take responsibility for, but are really implying. I give an example of that. A woman who lost a great deal of weight, and so here you see history too, because you know that was an issue between in that family. So she lost a great deal of weight and was very pleased, and all her friends told her how great she looked. And her sister said, "You're losing too much weight. You don't look healthy. Look how your collarbones stick out." Well, it was true. That was one of the things she had actually been rather pleased about. But what was the meta message? Was this the kind of sister speak? And I heard sisters tell me that they depend on their sisters for this kind of sister speak. She will tell the truth when nobody else will. Or is it another kind of sister speak where you feel you're being pulled back because your sister doesn't want you to get too far ahead? So in families where everybody's battling weight, they may not want one to get much thinner than the other because it makes her feel like, by comparison, because we're always dealing in comparisons with siblings, by comparison, she feels worse about herself.
Mm. That whole matter of comparison is particularly complicated, isn't it?
It is. I was so amused by some of the things I heard. So, for example, a woman who was 5'3" tall told me she feels like a hulking giant because her sisters are 5'1".
Mm.
In another family, she might feel like a Lilliputian.
Mm.
And again, the smart and pretty one, a woman who told me she graduated number 10 in a class of 200, but she still thought she wasn't smart because her sister graduated number 2.
Mm. You know, I guess one of the things that really had not dawned on me, it's funny how the most obvious of points sometimes really need to be said because they don't always dawn on us or are not made clear to us in so many words. As you explore this whole matter of sisters comparing themselves all through life and being compared to one another by others, one of the things you say that I think is so valuable is this: both the competition and the connection between sisters are complicated by inevitable comparison with someone whose life has been so similar to yours and yet so different, and always in your view. And there's a lot wrapped up in that. Of course, part of it is that these different comparisons and contrasts and so on, you see it so much better from your own perspective than from that of your sister. But the other thing you're saying there is that with sisters, it's two individuals and yet who share so many things together. And so naturally, you're going to compare yourself with your sister in a way that, you know, you're not going to compare yourself with Amelia Earhart or Indira Gandhi or somebody.
Exactly.
I mean, so that closeness, yet that contrast, it ends up becoming this dance. And if you don't dance it naturally or sensitively, it causes all kinds of trouble.
Yes, it's so true. And when you think about it, it's kind of natural that you do compare yourself to what you see. How do you know what you want except what you see around you? I think of a woman who said that when she was a kid, she said, "My sister got blue and I got pink, so I wanted blue." And it wasn't anything about the inherent value of blue or pink. It was about green. The grass is greener in your sister's yard. A specific example that comes to mind, I was talking to two sisters together, women in their 50s, and the younger one commented that the one regret she has about her life is that she did not go away to college. And her older sister did, and her older brother did. And I think we often feel we ought to have the same opportunities that our siblings have because it's the same family. Hmm. But that really is an illusion because it's a different family when each child is born.
Right.
So in that family, the mother encouraged the older sister to go away to college. She went to Spelman College, and it was her mother's idea. But the younger one lived at home and went to Howard University in her hometown, Washington, D.C. Well, how did that happen? Her mother said, "Oh, all my children are leaving. There's not going to be anybody left here." And she offered her a brand new car if she would attend university at home. So the mother, you could ask, you know, why did the mother encourage one and discourage the other from the same path? The situation was different. When you're the last one, that means only your departure empties the nest.
Hmm. That's intriguing, isn't it? And that brings up something else that you write about with such insight, I think, about that matter of when one sister makes a choice that another sister does not. And sometimes the feeling of longing that can create. I want to read this paragraph. "Many of us harbor two opposite impulses. One is to stay put, rooted in the place where we were born and raised, close to the people we knew as children, parents, other relatives, and friends. The other impulse is to leave, uproot ourselves from all that's familiar, discover other worlds, escape what we don't like about the place where we grew up or the people we grew up with. One urge calls us to follow an unfamiliar path. The other pulls us home. If you stayed close to home and your sister traveled far, or if you made the break while your sister stayed, she is the constant reminder of the lure of the life you didn't live. She is the side of yourself that may have been tempted or frightened by that other life. The way you respond to her, any combination of emotions, including admiration, envy, disapproval, disdain, can reflect how you regard the life she chose and you did not. And most important, the choice she makes changes your life, too." And I think that is remarkably insightful and is true not only about this particular matter of if someone leaves hometown or not, but revolves around all kinds of other questions like being or not being a mom, or working or not working outside the home, or going for a long-held dream of being a professional singer or whatever it might be, that in a particular way, in our sister, we can sometimes see the life we could have lived and did not.
Yes, thank you for reading that passage. I think you're right, and as I say at the end there, sometimes there's an animus because of the effect a sister's move has on you. So if one sister leaves town, goes to another city, the one or the more than one that is left in the hometown where the parents are often gets disproportionate responsibility as the parents age. So I heard more than one sister, women maybe in their 50s, 60s, even 70s, shocked that a sister said something like they're discussing the past, and she said, well, you left with a real resentment because of the responsibility that then placed on her. And even if it's not the responsibility, as you just read, it could just be a sense of resentment because you kind of wished you had done that. And because you didn't, you have that negative feeling about somebody else doing it, especially somebody who you have to think about all the time.
Something else you point out that I think is worth our talking about is that so many things can shift in people's lives. Their circumstances can change, sometimes drastically. I mean, the popular cheerleader and homecoming queen can be the one whose marriage falls apart and, who has to sort of rebuild things. And the mousy little bookworm might be the one who gets the wonderful job and achieves great success and status. And, I mean, life can be really full of surprises and changes. First of all, sometimes because sisters are sisters as long as they live, sometimes those old patterns and old labels remain stubbornly in place. But the other thing is that what remains stubbornly in place forever and ever is who's older and who's younger. That for all that changes in life, that's one thing that never changes.
Yes.
And there are some interesting things that play into how sisters interact in terms of older and younger.
Yes, one quote that I love, Bessie Delaney, there was a book some years ago, The Delaney Sisters.
Yes.
Bessie Delaney said of her sister Sadie, she doesn't approve of me sometimes. You know, she looks at me in that big sister sort of way. Well, when she said that, Bessie Delaney was 101, but her sister was 103. So the 2 years difference was more important in terms of their relationship than the entire century that they had lived. And at another point in the book, Sadie is quoted as saying, the only reason I'm alive is to keep her alive. If she lives to be 130, I'll just have to live to 132 so I can take care of her. That was so sweet. You often find older sisters feeling or acting protective, but also being accused of being bossy and judgmental, as we just heard. You know, she doesn't approve of me sometimes. Well, bossy, what's that? You're telling others what to do. Older sisters, when they're all kids, are often expected to tell the younger ones what to do, or just does it and gets away with it. And what is judgmental? It means you see how other people could improve, and you tell them. Most of the time, we don't tell them. We're thinking in our heads, if they did this or that differently, they'd be better off. But because of that feeling it's their job to protect the younger ones, older ones are often more likely to say something. And that's where you get these conflicting meta messages, where the impulse may be I'm being helpful, but it comes across as judgmental and critical. I also heard younger sisters frequently accused of not doing their part, just expecting the older ones to do everything. And when you think about, again, how it was when they were kids, perhaps there was really no space for them to do things because the older ones were already doing it. And perhaps they're afraid that if they do just volunteer and jump in and do something, they may be told they're doing it wrong. Because that also happened so much when they were young.
Yeah. I think sometimes it's intriguing, too, the distance between in terms of age. I mean, like my brother and I are 15 months apart, and I'm older. And so to me, I'm much older. And to him, we're the same. So that was a constant tug of war between the two. Whereas, of course, when there's more distance, sometimes those roles are clearly defined. But on the other hand, my wife and her sister are really flipped from what you just described. Mm-hmm. That is, her younger sister is the one who was always really law-abiding and eager to please her parents in every single way. And in many respects, my wife was the one who made all the mistakes from mm-hmm. which the younger sister learned. And many people, when they meet them now, mistakenly assume that the younger sister is actually the older. Any idea about when things end up being sort of flipped from what the normal roles are, how that flipping typically occurs, how or why?
Yes, although what you just described, I really wouldn't consider flipping because I do write about that. The older one often, I use the image as often sometimes like a lightning rod that absorbs the parents' insecurities.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Rigidness, right. So that's pretty common that the older one might feel that she was treated much more harshly. And often the older one is described as the rebel because she had to lead the way. So there are many different ways to be older and younger. But one way that does sometimes flip is if an older sibling, and again, this would be true of brothers as well, if an older sibling has some sort of handicap, physical, mental, or is just troubled and difficult, then the younger one will often take a role that we associate more with an older one. An example of that is Barbara Walters. She wrote a memoir called Audition, and the first word of that memoir is sister. And then she says she considered titling the book Sister because her sister was the greatest influence on her life because her sister had mental retardation, her older sister. And so she, Barbara Walters, the younger one, felt responsible for the entire family.
Wow. Something else I've observed with my wife and her sister and that that you touch on your book in your book is that I think once in a while they each make what I would call, I suppose, a mistake of sort of overestimating their own ability to sort of read between the lines of the other. That and I think lots of sisters do this because to some extent probably they can read between the lines. But sometimes when somebody says something, that's exactly what they're saying. And they're not saying anything more than that. And there is not hidden meaning to be discerned. And but I think a lot of sisters sort of pride themselves on being able to read between the lines. And that's just a lot harder to do than I think most people realize. And they need to do that with much greater care and maybe not even do that as much as they do. I don't know. What is your thought on that?
Yeah. Again, it's kind of the message, meta-message distinction. And you're absolutely right that we're always responding to meta-messages, and yet we think that we've heard it loud and clear. When I tell that example about the sister who lost weight and her sister said, "You're losing too much weight," that woman actually told me that she thought it had been intended in a constructive way. But I can see when I tell that story, often people, they wince and they look at me with a look that says, "You're ridiculous. You're so naive." Obviously, that was a put down.
Right.
So, yeah, I think you're right. And anytime we're reacting to implications rather than something put on record, nothing put on record is self-evident. Everything has meta-messages. There is always that risk that we think it's obvious, but it may be wrong.
And I think part of what you're saying is that because sisters share so much of the same life, I mean, grew up in the same home and so on, that they might even inadvertently or unconsciously be sort of deciding that they are close enough to sort of crawl inside the mind of their own sister and know what's really behind the words. And sometimes they do know and sometimes they don't.
Well, yeah, and especially, again, this is something that might be especially true of sisters. Many women are reluctant or hesitant to be direct about criticism and can use indirectness, and we know that we do that, so that's why we listen for it. Mm-hmm. There's an example that I really like. Amy Sheldon studies kids, little kids, and she has an example of where there are three little girls playing. These are preschoolers, and one of the girls wants to join their play, and the other two don't really want her to, but they don't say, "You can't play." They say, one is the mommy, one's the daddy, and then this third one that they really don't want to include, they say to her, "You can be the baby brother, but you're not born yet." So on the surface, they're letting her play, but they really aren't. And then later, she tries to get in to the play. You know, "Here's the baby." And they say, no, "You're still in the tummy." So knowing that often indirectness is used to convey what otherwise might get a negative response, we are more attuned to it.
Yeah. I guess that's maybe part of what you were saying when you wrote, we are creatures of conversation. This is our last point. By this, I mean two things. First, our lives are lived as a series of conversations. Second, we are creatures created in conversation, others as well as our own. When we think about people we know, we often recall things they said. And, of course, that is a very powerful message, whether we're talking about sisters or brothers or cousins or friends or whoever it might be. It really underscores the importance of what we say and how we say it and how carefully we listen to one another.
Yes. When women I spoke to told me about their sisters, they frequently told me something the sister said that they felt encapsulated exactly what they thought about her was good or bad. So, for example, as one woman was telling me that her sister never came through when she was needed, was very self-centered. She told about a very bad thing happening involving her kids, and when she told her sister said, "You're such a downer. Why don't you tell me about something fun you did?" So that's very common, that they would encapsulate what they saw as the relationship by repeating something that was said.
Well, there is so much for us to think about in this book, and I found it thoroughly interesting, and I can scarcely imagine how helpful and interesting this book will be for anybody who's a sister. The book, again, is called You Are Always Mom's Favorite, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives. It's published by Random House, the author Deborah Tannen. Deborah Tannen, once again, a great, great pleasure to talk with you about this fascinating topic and your marvelous book. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
It's exactly 8:57 here on WGTD, and tomorrow on The Morning Show, you will hear the interview that I recorded with Fiona Carnarvon, the Countess of Carnarvon. She and her husband, the Earl of Carnarvon, live at Highclere Castle, and Highclere Castle is where the series Downton Abbey and its following films were filmed. Fiona Carnarvon has written a really interesting book about one of her husband's ancestors, the fifth Earl of Carnarvon, who helped to bankroll and direct the expedition in Egypt that led to the discovery of King Tut's tomb. And her book is called The Earl and the Pharaoh, From the Real Downton Abbey to the Discovery of Tutankhamun. That will be tomorrow on The Morning Show. Also tomorrow, To the Last Breath, A Memoir of Going to Extremes by Dr. Francis Slakey. After that, the studios of WGTD are closed because of the holidays, but The Morning Show will go on in its podcast form. On Friday, I rebroadcast from the archives a memorable conversation with Hector MacDonald, author of Truth, How the Many Sides to Every Story Shape Our Reality. On Saturday, I'll rebroadcast a fun and memorable conversation about Dr. Seuss's How the Grinch Stole Christmas, an interview recorded back in 2007 on the occasion of the 40th anniversary reissue of the original book. On Friday, a representative of the King Arthur Flour Company talks about their Christmas cookie companion. That should be fun for Christmas Day. And then next week in the podcast version of The Morning Show, we're going to be rebroadcasting some of the most memorable, timely conversations from 2022, interviews tied to very special events or occasions. For instance, on Monday, you'll hear the interview that originally aired in late June, concerned with the 150th anniversary of Kemper Center here in Kenosha. On Tuesday, I will rebroadcast my final Morning Show conversation with now retired Gateway Technical College president Brian Albrecht on Wednesday, you'll hear the interview which I recorded with the director of one of the finest singing groups in America, Chanticleer, just ahead of their memorable concert at Carthage College back in the spring, and so on. So some memorable rebroadcasts as part of the podcast version of the morning show next week as our studios remain closed for the holidays. To look for the podcast, look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It's available through Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.